All right, so this is the Racial Equity and Policing Commission, the Policy and Practice Subcommittee meeting, Wednesday, November 4th, 4 p.m., 4:05 p.m. This meeting will be an electronic meeting pursuant to the Core Commission determination that conducting the meeting at a physical location presents a substantial risk to the health and safety of those who may be present at the anchor location. The subcommittee meeting will not have a physical location and all attendees will connect remotely. Meeting is available on Zoom and has been published on the city website. The meeting will be conducted by myself, Josh King, a commission facilitator with the Langdon Group. And again, further information is on slc.gov. Today, just to provide a brief overview of the meeting that will end at 5 o'clock. We have a few agenda items. We have some flexibility here in that we have under 11 commission members on this subcommittee. Therefore, we don't have some of those requirements where if we had 11 or more, we'd have. So we'll do brief overview of participants and process and administrative updates, review the previous meeting minutes that we had last week, and take a deeper dive into some of the scoped items, primarily use of force, and then have a discussion on next steps, what data the group needs or want, and what next meeting might look like and what some of the homework is, and set the meeting date for next week. And so with that said, I'm looking at who's in attendance and who we have from last week. I see Carol, Luna, Steven. We're all on the call last week, in addition to Andrew Riggle. So I want to give the opportunity to new participants to introduce themselves and welcome you to the group. So Hassan, I'll start with you since you're right next to me in the meeting. I also encourage you to turn on your cameras if you have the ability to do so. MJ is connecting, I see.
Hi, my name is Hassan. I'm here sitting on behalf of Allison for today, on behalf of the city council staff. So I'll just be sitting here for them.
All right. That's all you're going to tell us about you?
I'm a University of Utah student. Yeah, I'm a senior at the University of Utah student, and I'm excited to be part of this group, to listen in and see what's going on.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate you joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
All right. Beverly Hawkins, I have that showing on my screen.
Hi, let me see here. I'm a member of the Observer Corps for the League of Women Voters, so I'm just an observer, and I'm going to go off screen and off mute and mute myself.
Okay, thanks, Beverly. Okay. Thanks for joining us. All right, let's see. Desange.
Hi, everyone. My name is Desange. I'm currently a student at the University of Utah, and I am here with the Youth Committee.
Excellent. Thank you, Desange. MJ, as you were jumping on, I just wanted to recognize those that weren't on the call last week as participants this week, and you were on the call last week. So again, welcome. Brief review. I don't know if we don't need to approve the minutes, but I'd like to share them with the group just to have a quick overview if I can. So we're all on the same page. All right, are you seeing those minutes? Can you see those minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
All right. And so they've been sent out. What I just wanted to touch on was briefly my appreciation for last week. We had some good discussion and captured those here. Some of the main themes that jumped out to me were the desire to listen, learn, understand, to look at policies and the application of those policies and what those outcomes are, and determine if they're good outcomes, and if not, how might we restructure those or make recommendations related to those. With this committee, our main objective is to develop recommendations to provide to the commission, hopefully by the end of the year. And so I appreciate people's participation and joining in this. I'll also note that of our scoped items, we heard a lot about hiring policies, as you can see here in B3, and then again, hiring and firing policies here in E1 and 2, and it came up throughout our discussion. The core commission and staff made a determination in coordination with the officer recruitment committee that we'd merge the two committees and make this a focus of this committee. So moving forward, and probably next week, we'll get more into B, C, and E as one of the primary scoped items I see that this commission subcommittee has identified, one being use of force, and then two being accountability of law enforcement, which includes hiring, firing, policies, immunity policy, and a third area being funding, and then these other two items. So I think we identified last time that use of force is where we'd focus this meeting, but I think we'll have an eye towards looking at some of those accountability issues and policies moving forward. Does that sound good to the group? Okay. Excellent. One other administrative item, we can talk about this at the end, but since next week, Wednesday is Veterans Day. Well, I think we had a discussion last time to move next week's subcommittee meeting to Thursday, but we can tackle that at the end of this meeting. So with that said, I think due to our limited amount of time, I really wanted to focus the discussion on these scoped items, and the first one being use of force and chapter 300. Last week we had a discussion on that, and Mr. Cottrell brought up, or Mark, if I have permission to call you that, brought up the revisions that were made on October 6, 2020, and there was some discussion whether MJ, the youth subcommittee, and other commission members had that updated version. MJ, were you able to reconcile that? Were questions on that? Were you working off the most recent version, or was...
From what we were looking at, it seemed to be the most recent version, and then Coletta today sent us the use of force chapter as well. So we're reviewing that right now, but it looks to be the same thing along the lines of the issues that were raised last time.
Okay, great. And so it sounds like we're on the same page with updated version of chapter 300. I was also able to read and had seen it. I don't know if it had been shared with the group prior or if it would be helpful to the group, but there was an executive order issued on August 3rd, 2020 that speaks to the changes that were made in that most recent version, the October 6, 2020 version. Is that something that the subcommittee is familiar with, or would like a copy of that sent to him. It gives a little background on the updates made.
Are you talking about use of force in regard to the police dog, or just when the mayor put out, this is the changes we're making?
The latter, when the mayor put that out.
Okay. I remember that.
Okay. So if we're looking at that use of force statute, what is it specifically in 300 that jumps out to this subcommittee that we want to look at, that we might identify as areas that we can provide resources on or get clarification from staff or legal? And I know that we don't have Ephraim on here, who had a tracking document that he had shared with us and we looked at. MJ, do you have any specifics or particulars related to use of force or anything in general
that's up? Sorry, I'm trying to see if I can gain access to that same document right now. If it's plausible, would we be able to push this subject until he's also here to raise the points of his concern? I think he's running slightly late.
Okay, he's planning on jumping on?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. While we're waiting on that, any other comments or areas of concern related to the use of force policy and what's important here?
You know, this is going to sound really bad, but just that first sentence, the purpose and scope. Reasonably appears necessary. That's vague to me. And I don't know how it could be changed, but just that first sentence is a little scary.
And so I can't speak to this, but I have the same thought. Yeah, Carol, and I'm assuming, and Mark can clarify, but further in the chapter, there are more narrow definitions and clarification definitions, but the preamble I think could lend to some ambiguity.
I agree with Carol. I mean, that is just that's a lock in just that statement.
Okay, that statement, Stephen, and just following up with Carol, just the statement reasonably appears necessary?
Yes.
Okay. And is that a lot because it's very subjective in your mind, or what?
It is very subjective. And there's a lot of range right there.
Okay. Well,
there's no way to hold any accountability with that language.
Thank you, because I agree.
Yeah, Mark, go ahead.
Josh, I wonder if it would be helpful at this point to perhaps get into a brief discussion of Graham v. Connor, which is the Supreme Court decision from 1989. It sort of is what a lot of use of force policies in this country are based on. And that might help, you know, I don't want to put a value judgment on whether any particular provision is good or bad, but at least it might provide some context and framework where some of this language could be coming from. But I also don't want to derail any conversation that you have planned, but I just wanted to offer it as something I could go with now or maybe later.
No, I think that'd be valuable. As I brought up at the beginning, one of the primary themes I heard across the board was that interest in learning, understanding, and I think that's critical to making informed decisions and recommendations. So I'd support that, and I think it'd be valuable from what I'm hearing from the group.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. That's exactly what I was thinking. That'd be extremely valuable.
You
right about now.
Yeah, right about now. providing us a little overview, education right now.
Yes.
Certainly. And commissioners, thank you. And if you have questions, please just feel free to speak up. I will try to just do a brief overview because I'm cognizant of everyone's time here of sort of what Graham v. Connor is about. I know we've heard a lot about it over this past summer, and it may just be helpful to sort of focus on some of the key facts and language and sort of its legacy here. I will, Josh, do I have permission to share my screen? I think I do here. So let me first just go with, I'll try to share. I'm gonna share a few items here. So right here, I hopefully you've seen some language that shows what the Fourth Amendment language is here. Can you guys see that?
Yeah.
Okay, so just briefly read it. The Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The reason why I read that language here is that this is what case law focuses upon, is the Fourth Amendment, and particularly in areas of use of force. It's whether they view those as seizures by law enforcement. You're seizing a person, right, under the Fourth Amendment when you use force against them. And that use of force can be anything from detaining somebody to using deadly force. That's how the courts have looked at it. And so then they focus upon the word unreasonable in the Fourth Amendment and sort of flip it to what the question usually asked by a court is, was the seizure of the person reasonable under the totality of the circumstances? So just as sort of an underpinning, the Fourth Amendment is what the Supreme Court looks at. Next, hopefully, can you guys see, maybe you can't see it here. Let me try this, new share. And you'll have to forgive me with technology. I'm an old, as the youth may want to say, and I'm trying to get well-versed in Zoom technology here. This is sort of a brief primer on Graham v. Connor and what it means. And so the Graham v. Connor was a 1989 U.S. Supreme Court case from which a lot of use of force case law has developed. So understanding this will help us sort of understand how the courts look at things, right? And I'm not implying one way or the other whether that's good or bad. It's just sort of what the law is. So here, this case says that use of force implicates that Fourth Amendment objectively reasonable standard. It was the first case that held that the Fourth Amendment is what is how we view these use of force matters. And I apologize for this death by PowerPoint, but I thought it might be the most helpful way of sort of getting things out. The brief facts of it are sort of interesting, and I'll try to go through them briefly. Involved a diabetic who began to feel the effects of insulin shock, and a concerned friend, drove him to a convenience store to buy some OJ to deal with it. But when it went to the store, they saw a very long line, and they immediately left the store, and he asked his friend to drive him to another friend's house. An officer who was there saw Graham, the diabetic, feeling the effects of insulin shock, hastily enter and leave the store, and so he pulls them over. The driver tells the officer, hey, Graham is going into insulin shock here. We need to get him, you know, something like OJ. The officer says, hey, I'm just going to call the store to confirm that nothing is amiss. So the officer calls for backup, and during this time, Graham now feels the effects of insulin shock. He gets out of his car, runs around it two times, and then he sits on a curb where he passes out. Other officers arrive, and they handcuff Graham, the diabetic who went into shock, and ignore pleas from the driver to give Graham sugar. The officers believe him to be a drunk. He was not driving. And the officers pick him up and drop him on the hood of a car. Graham awakens, and he tells the officers, look for his diabetic decal in his wallet. He was then told, oops, to shut up and they slammed his face on the hood of the car again. Another friend shows up with OJ, and the officers refuse to give it to him. The store where he was called the officer back and said, hey, nothing was amiss. So the officers then release Graham, drive him home, and send him back to his home. During the encounter, Graham sustained a broken foot, cuts on his wrist, bruised forehead, and an injured shoulder, and all of the officers and the municipality were sued by Graham. And so issues about how to view that use of force were litigated up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in the matter said that if we're going to examine these cases, we're going to be looking at the following factors to determine whether a use of force is an appropriate use of force. And that is whether it's reasonable. So the test they look at is, number one, they look at the severity of the crime at issue. Is this merely a misdemeanor shoplifting charge, or is it a more serious, you know, ag kidnapping charge, or, you know, something like that? Are they looking at whether a suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officers or others? You know, is the person compliant and not doing anything, not moving, hands up? Or is the person reaching for a weapon, or is there a weapon in the hand? These are factors that courts have looked at in the past. Finally, the other factor is whether the suspect is actively resisting or attempting to evade arrest by flight. And some additional language that the court mentioned in their opinion, which is quoted a lot by other courts, is that when they look at whether the use of force is reasonable, they judge it from the perspective of a reasonable officer on scene rather than with the 20/20 vision of hindsight. So essentially, they try to put themselves in the shoes of the officer on scene who used force, and they try to look at what facts.
Ephraim has a question, Mark.
Yes, Commissioner Coombe.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I was wanting to ask the question after you finished the sentence, because my question was going to be, what do we do if an officer is not reasonable?
Certainly, and I can get to that question. I mean, there are, as we see here in the Graham matter, there's civil liability. If an officer doesn't follow the law, the municipality and the officer may be civilly liable to the person. There may be instances where that use of force was criminal, and they could be criminally charged as well. On top of that, with an officer, if they are operating outside a policy, there may be employment consequences for that officer as well. So there are, generally speaking, three avenues to deal with an officer who is not using force under the law. And I think that might be a topic that this subcommittee may dive into more in depth at a later time. And we certainly am more than happy to sort of explain what Utah law and federal law may say on those topics. I hope that answered your question, Commissioner Coombe.
Most definitely. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So just to finish up a little bit, I only have maybe two short slides to talk about Graham v. Connor here. So the language, as you see here, I mean, you judge it from the perspective of the officer on scene. What were the facts as known to the officer at the time? Certainly, as matters develop, there may be additional facts that are learned, but were those facts known by the officer at the time, and how did that view, and was it reasonable knowing those facts for the officer to use the force that they used? That's what a court should be looking at. This quote I pulled out because it's often used in cases. Not every push or shove, even if it may later seem unnecessary in the peace of a judge's chambers, violates the Fourth Amendment. The calculus of a reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force that is necessary in a particular situation. So courts, I see that quote a lot in cases involving use of force. The last slide I have here is that it must be objectively reasonable. And an additional quote that's used by courts oftentimes is sort of getting us to that standard. An officer's evil intentions will not make a Fourth Amendment violation out of an objectively reasonable use of force, nor will an officer's good intentions make an objectively unreasonable use of force constitutional. So courts are supposed to try to keep the officer's intentions out of it and just focus on the actions. So that's a very, very brief summary of Graham v. Connor and sort of where you, maybe it's one of the reasons why you'll see the phrase objectively reasonable or reasonable littered throughout the use of force policy. Are there any questions for me about sort of Graham specifically? If not, I'll go off camera and oh, sorry, Commissioner Coombe.
So I guess my concern with like how peppered the word objectively is throughout the manual is that, you know, objectively reasonable sounds great, but then they use such a subjective standard to base reasonableness off of. And I don't know, like, how do we like balance that?
And I think you've asked the question that a lot of that leads to a lot of litigation, quite honestly, because what does objectively reasonable mean? And is, you know, are the, is this set of facts something that a court should find is not objectively reasonable, or it is? And that's why we have litigation. And I'm trying to keep a value judgment out of that because I think that's for you guys to decide whether that language is appropriate in the policy. But you've hit on the million-dollar question.
Hey, Mark, similarly related to that, maybe we can draw a connection, but to Ephraim's question and Graham v. Connor, can you briefly describe, I know in Mayor Mendenhall's executive order, she referenced use of force and Graham v. Connor and you know, the standard she's looking for. Can you briefly describe the applicability of Graham v. Connor to the policies that the city has and has enacted and how they parallel or differ?
So I think the
brings the case law to policy.
Certainly, and I hope I'm responsive to your question here. I believe that why you see case law tied to policy so much is that essentially case law becomes the law. And it shows, and you certainly don't want to do anything that would violate the law, right? Certainly if we had a policy that said that officers, you know, shall be allowed to use deadly force on people who are not, you know, a threat to others, a threat to serious bodily injury or death to others, that would be very problematic from a civil liability perspective. You would want to have a policy that mirrored at a minimum the law.
Mark, can I ask you a question, please?
Absolutely.
I was going to ask you that question. Case law becomes the law. So this is written. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. This is written and we go into court. This is what they are judging the case on, correct?
And for the most part, Commissioner Shifflett, I certainly since 1989, there's been a body of case law on use of force within the federal circuit. So for example, and I don't mean to derail your question, with respect to the issue of the degree of threat that officers may face, in the 10th Circuit, which covers Utah, there's an additional, you know, set of four factors that a court may look at. But generally speaking, yes, case law becomes the law. It's what governs us, and it gets refined as we go forward.
It gets refined, meaning amendments can be put in place. Is that what you're saying by refining?
Yeah. So, for example, as we talked about, you know, the degree of seriousness of the threat that Graham v. Connor elucidated. There was a case that came out in 2008 out of the 10th Circuit. It's a state of Larson v. Murr. And there the court decided that they wanted to include some factors that a court should look at when determining the degree of threat facing an officer. And so they said in their test that you should be looking at whether the officers ordered the suspect to drop a weapon. So this is about deadly force. Whether the officers ordered the suspect to drop weapon and the suspect's compliance with police commands, whether any hostile motions were made with the weapon towards the officers, the distance separating the officers and the suspect, and the manifest intentions of the suspect. So you don't see those in the Graham case, but it's something a court felt might be more helpful in analyzing these things. And on top of that, I will say that, you know, use of force law, generally speaking, has been, the Graham is being tested a lot in different venues and courts. And I think there may be eventually a move to sort of provide a better framework in looking at this from the court perspective. Yes.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know, and I don't know if this is with you on the line or if this is just for the commission. My reason for asking is because we have to consider the bias of the police officer, that what he comes in with, what he comes into law enforcement with. And so it's a matter of perspective, this use of force and, you know, the case law becoming the law. This is where we need to talk about de-escalation as opposed to case law becoming the law, or as it comes to reasonable standards. I think this is where we need to talk about de-escalation training to get them to get that mindset out of their mind. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, noted, Carol. Thank you. Commissioner Shiflett, I don't know how formal to be, so if I am too informal, please let me know.
You're old enough to call me Carol. The two young ones have to call me Miss Carol. Sorry, guys. It's a respect thing.
Sure. Okay.
And I don't know how old Mark is, so we have to find out.
Mark and I are 2 weeks apart, so.
Oh, okay.
Commissioner Kuhn.
So my first question is, those circumstances that you kind of listed out, were those the four factors in the Fourth Circuit that you had mentioned? There was like one about ordering to drop a weapon. And are those factors you were talking about?
Commissioner, yes. So those are from the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. So that's the Federal Circuit governing Utah, as well as some other states in the region. And those were from a case called the Estate of Larson v. Murr. I'd be more than happy to provide a copy of the case to Josh, who could disseminate it to the subcommittee. But yes, there's that four-part test is part of the law in the Tenth Circuit.
Okay. And then my second question, what can be done as far as, I don't know. Like, I'm okay with subjectivity as far as reasonableness is concerned, but I feel like it would be more beneficial if that standard of subjectivity was based on the community as opposed to the department. And I'm just wondering, like, are there like possibilities with that? Would it require like litigation, or are there like shorter term and maybe less expensive and arduous options?
Another great question. You know, certainly from a policy perspective, I'm just trying to keep it general, and I don't want to, you know, impart any kind of value judgment from my end, because I think that's, again, the role for the subcommittee to make recommendations. You know, I think the city could come up with a policy that it wants, so long as it provides as much protection as the law would require, right? So for example, like the aforementioned example I gave of, you don't want to create a policy that tells officers to violate the law. That would be bad. But, you know, at a minimum, I think a policy would say officers got to comply with the law. And certainly whether to go beyond that. And I think the new use of force policy actually has done that, has provided more in there than what Graham necessarily requires. So for example, if you look at the policy, and I'll share my screen here briefly. And again, I don't mean to monopolize the subcommittee's time. So if I'm dragging on too long and there's a topic you want to get to, just push me and I'll go wherever.
While you're pulling that up, Mark, let me just see, is this helpful, not helpful, or okay? Helpful?
I'm glad we have Mark here.
Okay. Luna? All right. I'm seeing helpful, Mark. So Man.
Helpful.
Hey, there's a first for everything in my life. I'm glad I'm seen as helpful. So I'm pulling up, hopefully you guys see the most recent policy. And, you know, if as you look at it, there are things in here that, like de-escalation, right? There's a definition here. Graham v. Conner doesn't necessarily say anything about de-escalation, right? So that's something in SLCPD policy that goes beyond what Graham v. Conner requires. What else is in here? You know, certainly there's a lot of stuff in here. You know, here's the big de-escalation portion here.
The duty to intercede, I think, is a big one too.
Yeah.
And how would that contradict, are officers entitled to their own individual objective reasonableness standard? Or if they were supposed to intercede in an incident, would that contradict another officer's objectionable reasonableness standard? So that's something I kind of saw there as a discord as to where that action or that policy seems more of a reactive policy than a proactive policy and encouraging officers to kind of stop negative behavior before it begins, I think. That's something I noticed. But
yeah, Commissioner Powell, thank you. That's a good question. You guys were all asking good questions. Josh didn't tell me that you guys would be putting me through the paces, but helps keep me on my toes, I guess. That's the good thing. So getting back to that concept, Commissioner Powell, that you mentioned, which is about, you know, is it, how do you look at this objective, reasonable officer? And I think the courts are meant to sort of create this, it's not that each officer is their own objective, reasonable officer. That shouldn't be it. It should be this idea of you have an officer who's been trained, who understands the law, and then presented with a particular set of facts from their perspective, what they're able to see, what they know, how they're trained, how should that officer have acted in that scenario, right? Now, it's interesting, you may have a situation where you have two officers or multiple officers on scene, and they may be viewing different things. And so it may, from one perspective of one officer, it may be unreasonable to use force, but from another who may have a view of something developing that the other officer doesn't, it could be reasonable. Again, there are so many permutations of facts that could lead to that situation, but it could happen, I guess. And so it's, you kind of have to take your situations on a case-by-case basis. And that's why I think you see with a case law, this concept of totality of circumstances. Courts are supposed to look at the totality of circumstances involving the incident, and that would involve the perspective of the officers and all the things we just mentioned, the training, et cetera, their view, and then determine from that, was it objectively reasonable for that officer to use the force that they did? And certainly I know courts have come down in with certain decisions that people disagree with, and I think that also just shows you how difficult it can be to analyze these situations.
Thank you.
Yeah, and these are great, great questions. And I think the commission as a whole is looking at this subcommittee to dive in like this, to understand, to then bring back recommendations that intersect at the cross-section of viability, feasibility, and sustainability, right? Any recommendation ultimately needs to be viable, sustainable, and feasible. And for a subcommittee to make the determination or recommendation in that sweet spot needs to understand, I think, the backdrop here, which is case law and then the development of the policy. So, Mark, we appreciate it very much. I'm hearing the commission subcommittee does as well. We don't mean to put you on the hot spot, and know that you're a resource to us and our trying to be a resource without being subjective or cross any boundaries you shouldn't. So we appreciate it. With that said, a time check of 15 minutes. This is valuable. What moving forward, what would be valuable? Are there specific areas of this that you'd like to learn more about, or resources we can bring in from the PD to talk about application of it, or what, or do we want to look at those specific questions MJ and Ephraim have already started to dissect? What do you feel is most productive as next step diving into this policy?
Can I say something real quick? Thank you, Mark, for explaining that to us, because that, just those key, just what you told us, just for those few words, was very, very important. And it's almost to me, it's like we need to write a recommendation for the court to change that. That, I mean, that unreasonable. I'm not sitting comfortable with that at all. And I keep looking at Stephen over here and thinking, you know, I don't know if we're in the same age group or not, but as parents or as older people, you know, we've had to go through this time and time again. So, you know, saying that it's the law is just not good enough. I know we got stuck on the one first sentence, but to me, that's just so powerful that maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's where we need to go. But thank you, Mark, for breaking that down, because that's really important. Just that first sentence.
Thank you, Commissioner. And again, anything I can do to try to help, you know, demystify any of the legal concepts, so long as I'm not mystified by them myself, I'll try to do that.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Kuhn. President Kuhn.
Oh, no, I'm just a regular guy tonight. I'm
all right. Wrong context.
My question was going to be kind of going off of Ms. Carroll's point. Would it then be more productive as a subcommittee for us to pursue this from a court angle then? Like she was saying, maybe writing a recommendation, because I know that there's the option of like, kind of like with the updated use of force policy, it kind of goes beyond the law, but should any of those be violated, at least in the minds of the community members, and then that goes to litigation, there's no guarantee that there's going to be accountability in a court of law, because the standard of the law is lower than the standard of the police, and then there's so much subjectivity and ifs and circumstances that might not even guarantee accountability at that first level within the department policy. So would it be more like productive on our part to try to just go straight to the law, to the courts, however that may look like?
Yeah, I don't know if Mark or David want to field that as senior policy advisor, but yeah, we have certain abilities and parameters as a subcommittee, right? And you want to be the most effective with what we're doing here, what you do beyond here, and what direction you might go is up to your discretion. But related to that, I'm going to defer to Mark and David.
I'd be happy to at least speak about it from the legal perspective. Again, I think I can perhaps maybe explain how you can get involved when you're not a litigant and let you guys decide whether you feel that that's something that's worth your while or not, so that I'm not trying to persuade you one way or the other. If a non-party wants to get involved in a civil matter, for example, I think it may be difficult to do so with respect to, because you just can't appear, right? I know that when things go on appeal, you have to get permission to file what they call amicus briefs or friend of the court briefs, where there may be an issue that you want to raise before the court and argue that position. With respect to actual litigation, I don't know if parties in litigation might seek input, and if it was relevant and appropriate, a court might decide to hear it. Mechanically speaking, there are, I think, very few avenues to do so on a case that's before a trial court. Before an appellate court, you can perhaps get some amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs there. Certainly from a policy perspective, that's something that's, I think this subcommittee or commission could make recommendations about what that should be. And that's something that could be, you know, taken under advisement by the city or the police department to determine what to do with those recommendations. And policy is something that applies every day to the city or a police department. David might have some other ideas, but I think that's just answering those brief questions. I can only identify a couple of ways to get before a court on your recommendations.
Josh, if I may, Mark, I appreciate that response. I think that is kind of how I would look at it from a policy perspective in the work of the commission and the subcommittee in making policy recommendations, even if that means looking at advocating for changes at a state level. I'm not an attorney, and so I'm not nearly as smart as Mark, but it seems that and notice I didn't smile because it's totally true. It seems that affecting change through courts, as Mark says, much fewer avenues than trying, and courts are oftentimes the interpreters of policy changes. And so if policy changes, then could that objective, reasonable standard at a court level change as well? Is that, Mark, is that fair to say?
So I think in a way, David, I will say that just because we explored earlier the concept of whether we can go beyond what the law requires, right? So can you go beyond what Graham requires? And we highlighted parts of the policy that do go beyond what Graham requires. Now, if a court was to say that, hey, you didn't follow your policy on de-escalation, and because of that, let me rephrase it. Just because you violate your policy does not necessarily mean you violated the standards of law that have been set forth in case law. You may have required some additional steps by your own employees, but if they didn't follow those steps, and if those steps didn't violate the Fourth Amendment, then that wouldn't necessarily be a violation of the law. So I think David did bring up another avenue that I didn't identify, which was something that, you know, there's prime opportunity for with the upcoming legislative session, and that is to explore recommendations in state law. That might be one avenue. For example, state law has a statute that talks about use of deadly force when it's appropriate, when it's justified, I should say, and when it's not. And that's in state code. There may be other opportunities to weigh in on what, you know, relevant provisions of state law. And also, to a lesser extent, there may be, and I can't think of any, well, there may be, opportunities to try to figure out a way to change federal law too, right? Federal law, as this subcommittee discussed last week, kind of governs that concept of qualified immunity, which is a case law concept, but certainly federal legislation could affect qualified immunity. And that, I know that's something that has been discussed at the federal level. So identifying avenues of having an effect, there's certainly, you know, courts, there's state law, there's policy, there's federal law. There may be others I'm not thinking of, but
no, that's helpful.
Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, is that one, I want to ask if that's helpful. Then two, I want to ask Ephraim if bringing that back to this policies and practices subcommittee, if you, with what we have in front of us, if it'd be helpful to review the use of force section with more understanding of the backdrop of case law, and we can bring forward areas where they align or we feel they go beyond case law, and areas maybe where we feel they fall short and might want to make recommendations. What are your thoughts?
I like the sound of that, because I think there's like concerns that lie in both of those circumstances that you outline. If the policy goes beyond the law, then there's the concern that, you know, if the policy is violated, then the only arbiter of accountability is going to be the police department. And, you know, there's like no guarantees with that. I mean, there's no guarantees with anything, but there's less guarantees And then certainly if the policy is lesser than the standard of the law, then I think kind of having that, what's the word, like threshold or what have you, I think that sounds really good to me, if that sounds good to others.
Yeah, what are others' thoughts moving forward? Again, just bringing it back to the scope of what this subcommittee is doing and the commission is doing, empowered to look at the policies and practices and make recommendations. Is that a next step? Where can we be most effective? Where can we help you make the most change with what we have and what is in front of us?
I would be curious to see how the most recent application of the executive order by Mayor Mendenhall has gone into effect within the department. So I'd be curious to hear from a leader within that department on how they think these new tools and options give officers the right amount of protection and definition to go out and do their job within that objective reasonableness standard. I think, not to contradict or take away from President King's point, but before moving forward to a litigation process, I think it's critical to examine how these are impacting people doing their jobs and that are doing this day in and day out. And so even if we had Steve Angie Warden here to discuss what he thinks the executive order's done on terms of impact, I'd be curious as to that. But definitely want to hear from inside the department before we move to litigation talk points.
All right, thank you. Let's vet that out, because I think Mark has laid a great foundation with case law, or a backdrop for us of case law, an overview of the statute. And what I hear MJ saying is, okay, let's look at application of this and what those outcomes are, or how the PD is training on this and how it's actually being used and applied. Would that be another level that commission would like to look into before really diving in and making recommendations on use of force?
I definitely agree with MJ. I'd love to see that information and have someone from that division come in and speak towards that before we make a decision or a recommendation.
All right. That could give the commission subcommittee time to review the use of force updates, Mayor Mendenhall's executive order, and perhaps some of the case law, and digest what we've heard today. If this is feasible and possible, I'll defer to Mark and David on that, and maybe we can look into that throughout the week. But my understanding is that, yeah, we can do that. Okay, great. And so we've identified several documents and things to share. Everything will come through Coletta. Hassan is on the call, and us taking notes and minutes and tracking action items so that we can have a process that's efficient, get quick turnaround, so you guys have this before a day before the meeting to review and digest. I know the last day or two, and even today, has probably been a lot to process and digest. Last thing you want to do is dive into a statute or a policy manual, right? And so I'm hearing next steps would be to get the info for you to digest. We'll look at someone internally from the police department coming to speak to use of force and application of that and training of that within the police department, particularly since, and Mark, has the 10-6 20 amendments been adopted and implemented yet?
Yes, they are in policy.
Okay.
And they should have received training on them. Yes.
Okay. Does that sound like a good, MJ? Is that a hand raise or itch or a thumbs up? All right, thumbs up, or down. Okay, And again, I was talking to Dante and we were talking, you know, this isn't a sprint. I'm like, it's not really a marathon either, right? This, it's more like a 4x100 relay, right? It's going to take a little time, but we are moving fast, or maybe a 4x400 relay. So I think it's critical to get an understanding, because you guys and I, we don't know what we don't know. And so we want to know before making decisions. So I appreciate your direction and patience. So we'll work on that from our end to set that up for next week. Do I remember correctly that we decided since next Wednesday is a holiday, we'd push it to Thursday at 4? Is that our plan? Does that still work for everybody?
That's what we got from Coletta, I believe. Yeah, next Thursday.
Yes.
All right, so we'll put together the action items, the resources from this call. Coletta is our air traffic controller to collect and process them out to you. So look for those in the next day or two, and we'll work on setting up the agenda and arranging for that next step in the meeting next Thursday. Anything to add from any of the subcommittee members or David or Mark?
Josh, I just want to clarify to make sure I heard correct and understand correctly that we would like to have someone from Salt Lake City PD next week if we can make that work on the calendar.
Yes.
Thank you.
I've got nothing else. The only thing I might add is if you guys anticipate any type of legal questions, and I know that things pop up all the time. Certainly, Josh, if you wouldn't mind getting in touch with us sooner than later so we can make certain that we can prep and be ready for it.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And to Mark's point, as we talked about, David and Mark talked about state legislation or other parallel efforts that might be going on, and you'd like that resource or something that pops up on your radar, let us know. All right. Carol, I'm sorry for going 2 minutes over. I know you and others probably have something at 5 o'clock and now you're gonna be late.
No, I'm fine. I have a little break. I do have like 2 more meetings tonight, but I'm good. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks to everybody. I know there's uncertainty around where we're going, what we're doing, but it's an iterative process and appreciate your buy-in and moving it forward.
Thank you.
Make sure to make it a homework assignment to review the executive order as well as the revised policy for Chapter 3 and come back organized. Thank you.
A homework assignment, huh? Yeah, right. Top of everything else.
We'll bold that in the follow-up email, MJ. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll leave that to you guys. How about that? Interpret for me. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good
night.
Thank
you.
Good night.
Good night.